drill sergeant saying, "Get up, you fucking loser, and don't be such a loser!" Faster, faster, faster I went, creating a much more momentous friction than before. It wasn't happening. Still? Why? What's it ever going to fucking take? My voice answered me back. "It's going to take everything. Nothing comes easy. Earn it, goddammit!" So I did, and I put everything of myself into it, and the whole world fell away, and all I could hear was the silence of my mind that had been so noisy with negativity the last few days. Now it was clear, and I had focus. I don't care if your hand falls off. You are going to create fire, period. I kept going at a furious, physical, out-of-body rate, and all of a sudden, I heard other voices float in like a wave on a shore. "You're doing it. You're doing it." I opened my eyes, and sure enough, smoke. I couldn't stop. I kept throwing my arm back and forth on some insane autopilot, looking around with wild eyes. The guys ran over and said with an urgent voice, "Okay, okay, no, pull back and start to blow on it." I looked at him, confused, still pushing and pulling, and he said, "If you keep going, it will go out. You have to slow down and get the kindling going, and then the smoke will turn into flame." I was so scared to stop, as if it would all fall apart. But I did. I came to a slow wind down and started blowing. The guy said, "Slower, less wind. You don't want to blow it out. Slow." And so I whispered my breath onto my little smoking bird's nest. And then it happened. It burst into a tiny flame before my very eyes. I looked up so excited with wet and apologetic eyes. And my girlfriends looked at me with pride. They knew what I was going through, and they just wanted to see me do my best. That's what friends do. Later that night, the guy said that they had a special treat for us, and they rolled out 3 sleeping bags they must have had up their ass because they were produced out of nowhere. Come to think of it, there was a new guy who joined our group that day. Maybe he brought them. But I was thrilled, and I could have never appreciated it the same way if I hadn't been through what I had been through. Simple as that. Everything has to get taken away. It has in my life, too. Everything went away when I was 13, and I lost my job, my credibility, and my freedom, and I had to rebuild everything. But like with the fire, I didn't give up. I may not have done it with grace, but I fought my way into something better and more enlightened. And I will have many more rounds to go in life. But this was a big one. My lesson here was you do not give up. You hold yourself accountable. You stay grateful. You hold on tight to your friends. I felt tired and content. The other girls and I went into different areas, and we were all happy to embrace this place independently for one night after being Velcroed to each other the last 2. I slept, a deep and peaceful slumber under the moon and stars. I was in my cozy Eddie Bauer sleeping bag, but I slept in Mother Nature's arms. And when I woke, the 3 of us met back up. We were finally alone and took a long bath in the river. We stripped right down and took a naked bird bath right there in the wild. It was a moment. And we all knew it. Mental picture for life. When we rejoined the group, we hiked for a few miles and finally returned to the place to be picked back up in the van. I felt so different than I did when it dropped me off that it was shocking. But here I was, changed and recharged. I got up in the van and went to my spot in the back, this time by choice rather than by rejection. I looked out the window. I heard the voice in my head come back in one last time, and the tone was different, calm and kind. It said, "You never give up. and you ask yourself how you got here. Did you put yourself there? Can you get yourself out? That was your lesson. Don't forget it. I won't, I told myself. I promise I won't. And I didn't. I went home, and we made a beautiful success out of the film. And once again, I was simply relieved. But much more important, I had grown up a little bit more, right at the point when I needed to. Africa. One day in 2004, I was sitting in a coffee shop by myself having breakfast. We were making the film Fever Pitch, and it was a really happy time. The Red Sox were winning and about to make history. I was single and enjoying reading the New York Times when I came across an article. It said, "Children line up to get into classroom," and it was accompanied by a picture of tons of kids neatly lined up in rows sitting on the floor, looking toward the head of the class. These kids had this eager and beautiful look in their eyes. It could not have been more contrary to the look I saw in the classroom in my own experience. These kids fought to be in there. And as I read on, it had to do with the fact that the World Food Program was providing meals. My heart broke. I couldn't have felt more humbled at that moment, and something took over. I was overwhelmed with empathy and curiosity. I wanted to be transported there right at that moment so that I could better understand the world of this tiny school. Something was moved inside of me to the point where I went home and picked up the phone, only to realize I had no idea who to call. So I started calling people I worked with. And then I was transferred to the UN. When I started my inquiries with them, I was presenting myself more as a volunteer who wanted to learn. Not wanting to take on some celebrity who wanted a photo op was their concern, and I truly appreciated that. I explained that I was allergic to that as well, and this was not that. This was me, just a tiny human trying to educate myself on how their programs functioned. They thanked me for my interest and said they would get back to me. 1 year later, I got the call. It was actually from Marie Claire magazine. They had heard somehow that I was interested in going to Africa, and they had a contact at the UN. If I would write an article about my trip, they would help me get there. They were my liaison and my funding. I had an assignment, and I was so excited. I was to take a trip and go directly to Kenya and meet a UN aid worker at the airport. His name was Ben. He was British and immediately had that air of, "I hate celebrities." "Oh dear," he might as well have said, "Listen, Florence Nightingale, don't try to make it seem like you care, because this is a full-time job and not a swoop in and snap a picture and leave situation." It was similar to when I called. Again, I really respected this. We started right away by going into Kibera, which they called a slum, and it was one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Africa, let alone Nairobi. We went in the UN vans with the two UN letters painted on the side of the cars. Ben said that was to let people know who we were, because the UN was seen as friend, not foe. The UN had no agenda and usually was a symbol of help, because if you were thought of as a threat in these parts, you could be killed. Simply put, these were incredibly dangerous places to be, and my first wave of, "What am I doing here?" washed over me. There was trash piled up so high that it was the height of a two-story building. Dirty water everywhere. Tiny little storefronts that were 10 by 10 feet with a mattress on the floor, and these were what people lived in and worked from. There was also a whole world inside of these places, and many people only left to go work at other jobs. The infrastructure, as dire as it was very insular. I had never seen such a world. When we got to the school, the few people running it came out to meet us. We all shook hands and introduced ourselves. But then, a wash of bright colors sailed through my vantage point, and these kids started piling out of the small structure to line up. It was obvious that something of a greeting ceremony was choreographed, and they were about to perform it. All of the outside world and pain fell away, and the brightness of these kids changed my life forever. It was a Technicolor wake-up call. We spent the whole day with the kids. After their dancing and singing, they took me into the classroom I had fantasized about for the last year. It was shadowy, as the only light that came in was from cracks and a few cut open spaces in the walls. The flags and tiny quilts that the teachers had made by hand on the walls were educational and poetic. There was warmth to this room, and I knew I was in the right place. I sat in on a lesson and watched these kids practice their English and math. I asked all the kids what they wanted to be. One kid raised her hand. A pilot. Really? I said, amazed at her answer. You can take everyone to see the whole world. Then the next one raised his hand. A doctor. Wonderful, I said. You can take care of everybody. And when I said that, they all laughed. But not a ha-ha laugh, but a hopeful laugh. Another kid raised a hand. A scientist. Well, I said, you will solve all the problems. And another laugh. It astonished me how they were all practical and ambitious occupations. There were no artist or mother or singer aspirations. They wanted to do important things in the world. Again, my heart shifted and grew bigger. At the end of the day, they took me to the tiniest closet, which was the kitchen, a wood-burning makeshift stove on the ground with a giant tin pot on it. The pot had porridge in it that also had an oil placed in it, and the oil was full of nutrients and vitamins. This was where the World Food Program came in. Ben explained that the kids got one or two cups, depending, one in the morning and one for lunch. It was a red cup made of plastic. Sometimes the kids even saved some of their meals to take home and share with their family. But without this program, many kids had to struggle to get any food at all. It was one of the reasons they came to school, to get an education, but to be fed as well. I was acting like I was taking it all in because I didn't want to break down. I thought Ben would have killed me for being a weak starlet who couldn't hack the harsh realities of these surroundings. I just stayed stoic and kept writing things down in my notebook and making notes. I was taking a journalistic approach. After all, I had told the UN I was here to learn, and I would do just that. After we went home that night, I couldn't sleep because of jet lag and everything I had seen that day. When the morning came, I was eager to get back into Kibera and learn more. We were now joined by a man from the UN headquarters named Leonello, an Italian man who lived in Geneva and ran the offices. We would be going to a different school that day. This school was more focused on the issues of girls. Rape and genital mutilation were giant problems in this area. Again, I took out my notepad and asked questions, but inside, I was dying. I was feeling in over my head again. I wanted to tackle kids in school, and what I was learning was about the food they thought to eat and the circumstances in which they were living. This was more about how to survive, and the schooling was a great luxury. I was almost catatonic, but I saw Ben looking at me for a reaction, and I stayed strong. I was not going to give him the satisfaction of seeing me break like a little bitch. I was among people who dealt with this every day. They were the heroes, and I just wanted to be quiet, respectful, and keep up. We went through the school, and at this one, the kids sang us another greeting song. It was beautiful. When they had started, I was so shaken up again, wondering what I thought I could ever do here. How could I help? I felt out of my league and totally inferior when these kids' voices overtook the self-doubting ones in my head. Their song and joy completely wiped the slate clean, and I told myself, it is about them. If the World Bank could not solve poverty issues and I could not protect each and every one of them the way I wish that I could because no one could, I could just try and help individual schools. I could try to help these places function one at a time. Maybe even just start with one. Ben said it was not that simple and that the money anyone donates goes into a blanket surplus for all the schools or emergency situations. The UN and the WFP are usually some of the first feet on the ground in a crisis situation around the globe. I knew I had definitely found the right place with the WFP. The question was, what was my part in all of this? I spent the rest of the week there going to several schools in a few areas. Eventually, we went far outside the city into rural places. We passed through a huge vista that is an indented crater in the ground, as far as the eye can see, and I sat there on the side of the road marveling at it. The schools outside the city were a complete shift in landscape and facility. A lot of these schools were live-in boarding schools and actually had land. Although it was arid and not as hospitable as you would like, they had a quieter and calmer feeling. Space. The dangers weren't 10 feet away. Yet they were no different in what they needed and that they functioned on school lunch programs and donations to stay afloat. Next, I was taken through a few villages of the Maasai Mara tribe. This was where I was seeing a part of Africa that looked epic and familiar. They were dressed in bright red plaid that was wrapped around them. They had giant wooden hoop earrings in their lobes, tribal markings on their skin in black and white, and beaded necklaces up to their chins. It was beautiful and incredible. I was being taken there to learn about where a lot of the traditions come from and to have a better understanding of the way these people lived. They lived in huts that were made by women, and the men frequented different ones every night. The boys were sent out into the Mara to have warrior quests, where they would become men, and the girls had a path that was set for them long ago. Again, this was tradition dating back at least hundreds of years and was not to be questioned, certainly not by me. But I understood how the girls who were able to go to school were getting to have a different way of life indeed. It all seemed a world away out in nature, and yet that's where the girls came from. So it did truly help inform me. Leonello said we would go back to one more place on our way home. It was a hospice for sick children. As soon as we pulled up and got out of the car, this particular little girl started walking by my side. I smiled at her and we kept looking at each other, a sweet cat and mouse game of glances. We went into the building and it was a little hospital, but it had actual concrete walls as opposed to mud or wood. It was small and quaint, but it had a really nice feel to it. It was still in a brutal area, but it felt safe. And I was so happy that the kids had a nice place to be until I realized why they are there. All the kids had different ailments, and I met them and learned about their stories. The little girl who was following me was now sitting next to me. I watched her. I had been around adults my whole life, and without siblings or cousins, I just didn't have a relationship with little children. In fact, I knew they could smell my fear. And then I was a bit undesirable because I just didn't know how to relate to them. Kids are pure instinct as well, and I could tell they could always read my inability to engage. So I was playing it cool with this wonderful little girl. But then I dared to ask her her name. Edith, they told me, as she only spoke Swahili. But not having to use words probably helped us. And within a few more minutes, she was holding my hands. Even when I did try my hardest with kids, they didn't like that I was trying so hard. I was just a failure at being what kids wanted or needed. And eventually, by my 20s, I just stopped trying. I just kind of wrote myself off and hung out with the adults. But Edith was giving me the biggest compliment of my life by wanting to be around me. Not only was I humbled and honored in a way I had never known, I was so grateful for her unspoken bond. As the day went on, I can honestly say I fell in love. Her calm charm and affection woke something up in me that had lain dormant inside since I was a kid, not understanding what a kid is. We were like two peas in a pod, giving each other something we both needed. I asked Leonello why she was here. "She has AIDS," he said. "Oh," I nodded, and I held her hand tighter. When it was time for us to pack up and leave, I was shaking. I didn't want to unlatch from Edith. Unwrapping my fingers from her was a violation of what we had formed on this life-changing day. I said my goodbyes and hugged her over and over. We got in the car, and I waved to her as we pulled away until she wasn't visible anymore. I turned around and looked out the windshield and lost it. I felt so many feelings. Hopeless, hopeful, changed, clear, convicted. I turned to Leonello. "I want to sponsor her." He asked how I meant, and I said, "I don't know, but I need you to help me. I need you to help me set up a trust for her and have the money get directly to her. Can you do that?" After weeks of hearing how hard it is to get funds to actually make an individual difference and yet how the UN is saving lives with 50 cents a day, I saw there was such a chasm between miracles taking place and there still being so much to do. Somehow, starting with her was a way for me to figure out how to give money in a productive way that was also so personal and meaningful. I would get to bigger economic issues once I learned more. Leonella looked at me and said, "We will get it done." And I breathed for the first time since we left that children's hospital. I stared out the window and took in a country I had no idea I would be in 1 year ago. I ended my trip having felt like I really experienced different landscapes. We took propeller planes and long rides through the terrain for hours and hours on end. Marie Claire even sent me to a safari camp for one night just to say thank you for writing this article. When we returned back to the bustling city of Nairobi, it seemed like a surreal Mecca. And yet there was conflict here. I felt confused yet awake. We all decided, our little crew, to go have a drink that night as I was departing in the morning. We recounted the last 10 days and asked questions about each other's personal lives. We were getting to know each other a little more. It was nice to decompress for a moment. And that's what amazed me. These UN workers had a great sense of humor. They didn't want to wallow every second. I guess they wouldn't survive if they did. They were matter-of-fact about problems because they were in it, doing something about it the best they could instead of cowering at the vastness of it. They seemed like superheroes, and yet they were taking off their masks and having a drink and revealing that they couldn't be more human, and fun humans at that. The next morning, when Ben took me to the airport, he seemed different, less judging and more relaxed. But when he walked me to the check-in desk, he said, You know, when you got here, I interrupted him. I know, you hated me. No, he said, shaking his head and smiling. I just didn't know if you were full of shit, and it seems like you're not. Phew. Ben was giving his own brand of approval. He even said, come back. All of a sudden, I knew that there was a part of him that was also saying, because I bet you won't. And I looked at him and smiled. I will, I said, with the sight of watch me, fucker. And with that, we silently dared each other, and I left to go to my plane. I wrote my article all the way home as I had ample time, and I wanted to write it fresh off the experience. After a few days of being home, I was amazed at how much abundance we live in when I entered a grocery store. I got really depressed and felt guilty and totally disoriented. I felt like I couldn't look at anything the same, and yet I had only scratched the surface. What did I know? I knew this was my life out here, but I knew something else now and I couldn't shut it off. After a few weeks of wandering around, I got proactive and called the UN again. I'd like to go back, please. And a few months later, I was flying on a return trip. I walked through the airport and saw my greeter. Instead of being shy, I walked right up to Ben and said, "Did you miss me?" Because we didn't need to discuss the fact that I had taken his silent bet and I was back. And this time, for a few weeks. "Let's do this," was my feeling this time, and we went straight into a refugee camp. And as much as I was nervous, I felt like the training wheels were off. There was no one sponsoring this trip, and it was time to go even deeper into the world I had come to care so much about. The refugee camp was huge. Our bunks were in a fenced-in, secured, makeshift UN compound with tiny concrete structures, about 10 by 10 feet, that each had a single cot and a small wooden table and lamp. That's it. Yet it was very hospitable. Again, in comparison to what other people are living like, it is a great luxury. And you are well aware of every gift you get. We were given dinner, Ethiopian food, and a beer. Tusker beer, and we drank one under a tree that had falling bugs. They would cascade right down on your head. The bugs were so large that you would get up out of your folding chair and run at least 10 feet, and everyone would laugh at you for getting so scared. But these bugs were the size of small bats, and I couldn't help but flip out, even though they said they were harmless. I will never forget that night. It was a moment to decompress and yet be accosted by giant raining insects. The next day, we got our start. I was on a tour of schools again as I wanted to refine my dedication. Schools specifically are what I was passionate about, and they were a contained target. I felt like I could be effective there. It was ironic that I didn't have school as my main priority in my own life, and I was so moved by how these kids fought to be here. I would go to different ones to find out what they really needed, what were they lacking, and what it was that was making them thrive. Some kids had to walk too far, and that made it dangerous or difficult. Villages that didn't have water were a major issue. Schools that had a boarding aspect were more desirable in more desolate parts, and yet in the dense, overcrowded cities, the problem was sanitation. Again, it can get very overwhelming very quickly, but I went around for 3 weeks really studying what needed to be done. The World Food Program introduced me to an Olympic athlete, Paul Turgot, who was a product of the school feeding program. It was because of the food he was able to train and have the energy to run, and because of the education, he understood what it was going to take to get himself to a place where he could have opportunity. He took me to his original school, and he and I planted a tree there. It was a very happy school with a little bit of land, and the kids were so vibrant and fun. We went to his old house nearby, and I met his family. It was amazing now to be working with someone who was proof of what was possible, and he had important things to say about how it all functions. We moved on to several areas of Kenya, and I fell in love with the village of Kiltimani. I could see that building a borehole here would transform the entire place and bring water to where people had to walk at least 5 miles a day to fill up a small pitcher. And there was a school and lots of kids, and it seemed like a wonderful place to build upon. The people were so kind and informative. There was a community, and it affected me and made a lasting impression. When I was leaving this time, I spoke very seriously to Ben and Leonello about what we could do first, how much it would cost, and what were the priorities. First, it was money to sustain schools in the area for a year. Then it was helping build these advanced boreholes, which brought water to places in need. Then it was consideration of building my own school, and if so, where? Again, I had been to so many places at this point, where did I feel a connection to laying down a foundation that could be sustained and monitored? It was a lot to process, and I didn't want to just give money and not see where it went, but I also understood that so much money was needed. How could I be most effective? And when I got back to America, I went to the UN in New York, and I got my full ambassadorship. I worked with a woman named Bettina, and she and I planned out ways to bring awareness to the program. I got a UN passport, and it was the greatest day. I felt so proud and excited to be a part of a place with such meaning and effectiveness. And so, I went out touring places on the World Food Program's behalf and tried to get the message out. I wanted to fulfill my position by trying not just to donate my own money, but also get others involved. But I liked my groundwork the most. When I was actually there, and no one knew where I was, that's when I really thrived. I decided to build my school, and I picked Isiolo as the location. I started getting plans and blueprints. I was so excited, I couldn't stand it. Things were actually happening, and I felt so grateful. About 2 years later, when I started dating my husband, Will, who was just my boyfriend at the time, I got a call that the school was ready to be visited. It wasn't fully up and running, but it was ready to make the decisions to finalize it. I had never taken anyone with me on these trips. They were very solo for me, and I had yet to share any aspect of this with anyone. But I took a risk and asked Will if he would like to go with me and see it. He said an absolute yes, and off we went, back to Africa. This time I had something to show, and I was very excited to bring him into my world there. After many days and hours of travel, we went to the site of the school. There were already children there. I played with all the kids, and we served lunch. They walked me over to a little painted sign that said, "The Barrymore Learning Academy," in hand-painted letters, and the whole thing just seemed so real and brought so much joy at that moment I could have burst. Just then, Will took out his camera and took a picture of me with the kids under the sign. Click. And I knew, right then and there, that my fears and apprehensions about my energy and how kids perceived it was officially over. Through my learning what they needed, I felt healed of something that had always been painful. A kid who didn't know how to relate to kids. But not anymore. I could love freely. My heart was as open as it had ever been in my whole life. Before we left, I made my way to see Edith. She had grown so beautifully. She was taller and healthy. I ran right into her arms and introduced her to Will. We had all met at a park, and her caretaker, who was funded by the trust, brought her. I spent the afternoon putting my fingers through hers and holding hands with her. I was so happy to be back with her. I was so happy to see how happy she was. And yet there was still that calm in her. But her smile was exactly the same. I am so glad she chose me in this world. I feel lucky, and I can only hope to continue the favor. And this time when we said goodbye, I wasn't a total wreck because I knew she would be okay. We hugged for 10 minutes straight. When I went home after this trip, something had shifted inside of me. I thought about getting ready to have my own children. It was time to start learning and investing in what it would mean to become a loving mother, and I knew I was ready. This decade changed me. If I hadn't read that article that day in the diner, my whole life might be different. Or are we set up on paths we must go on, and there are little breadcrumbs out there to lure us in? I don't know, but I now know a lot more than I did. And these are the lessons and the values I will instill in my girls. They will have to find out what is important for them, but I am glad that our house will be so encouraging of that. Every Mother's Day now, I make a Hallmark card for the girls to tell them what I did in their honor. I make donations, or I go and drop off gifts, or we do a volunteer day. It's always for children-related charities. That is what speaks to me. It's what moves me. And until my kids are old enough to figure out what their cause is, I will do it for them so they get a jump start on all of it. It is crucial in my life to do this. I hope I can inspire them. I will do my best. And this is where I put my faith in the rule that kids follow by example. They won't learn a lot from my silly dances, but hopefully I can be of help to push them towards thinking outside of themselves. Africa was my wake-up call, and I'm so glad the UN actually took my call. In-law jackpot. I walked into the apartment on the Upper East Side for the first time during spring. Will and I had been dating only a few months. It was my maiden voyage into his parents' place, which he lived in as a child. I went from room to room, taking it all in. The art on the walls, family pictures everywhere and frames on the wall. There was a room full of books, a cozy and beautifully appointed kitchen. But I was smitten with the old-school cordless phone from the 1980s that remained. There was an undeniable warmth, and all these photographs I kept studying told a story of this close-knit family. One had Will at college with his parents the night of a school play. He and his sister Jill in a field of flowers as children. Will as a baby asleep on the beach. Grandparents on their honeymoon. I took them all in, piecing them together like a puzzle to understand my boyfriend's life. Not only was it different from my own, sure, we both had a set of fancy grandparents, but this whole life of togetherness captured was something unfamiliar and, frankly, intimidating. I felt my West Hollywood urchin start to kick in. My inner voice, "You don't belong here." And what made it the hardest was attempting to look at his parents. Ari and Coco Kopelman had been married for 39 years with 2 children. William and Jill, and they had a wonderful life. Good schools for every generation, great amounts of world travel. Ari was once a Mad Men advertiser and had worked at DDB, one of the biggest agencies in the 60s. He was truly smart and creative, but he had an incredible business sense. So one day, one of his accounts, Chanel, whom he had worked with in advertising for 15 years, called and said, We want you to come run our company and become president here. They are a family-owned French company, and they also joked, where else are they going to find a man with a wife named Coco? It was too perfect. He worked there for 20 years. He has since retired, but remains on the board. Ari had met Coco when she was in college. She was a French girl living in Manhattan, going to Parsons School of Design, and had aced her baccalaureate tests, as she was incredibly intelligent, smart, stylish, and 20 years old. Coco Franco met Ari Kopelman, and on their first date, he took her to the 21 Club in the city. Things went so well that 3 months later, on her 21st birthday, he took her back to the 21 Club and proposed. 21 is Ari's favorite number. So this was what I knew. This is as much as I had learned when Will said his parents wanted to go to dinner and meet me. I had suggested the 21 Club as a fun idea, and they liked it. But I was freaking out inside. Would they like me? Would they be skeptical? Were they cold people even though their apartment would suggest otherwise? Would they look at me and have that prove-it attitude towards me? I was dating their son, after all. Somehow, this felt like the biggest audition of my life. Although Will and I had been dating only a few months, the girl in me felt the need to become a woman with him. I knew this was different. I had been a this-is-who-I-am person. All my life, I had dug my heels in with men, and all of a sudden, I was not fighting for the same things anymore. I could see a life with this man. It was new, but the stakes felt high. And so I made my way around the corner from the hallway and heard their voices. Will was clearly hugging his mom, and I heard Ari's voice asking a question of some kind. All I know is I was looking down at the ground. My heart was pounding. Most people don't like the parents of their partner. This is a fact. There are movies about it called things like The In-Laws, and those movies are about the trials of the family meeting the new girlfriend, and then it all goes crazy. I took a deep breath. My gaze finally started to rise, and before I could look at their faces, Coco was extending herself and giving me a hug. I saw Ari over her shoulder with a big warm smile. I started to relax my tense body and turn into a grateful girl who didn't feel judged all of a sudden. Maybe I had judged myself. I was worried about a possible preconception of the actress girl Will was bringing home, and that intimidation started to fall away, and being my own person kicked in, and I was able to just be myself, which is always the best way to be. But it truly helps when people disarm you, especially by taking you in their arms. Off we went for a great double date at the famous 21 Club. The dining room had old model planes hanging from the ceiling and beer steins all around the bar. The space had character and warmth to accompany the tone of the evening. Coco ordered steak Diane, and Ari ordered martinis. We spoke about our lives and got to know each other. Coco is sophisticated and insanely smart. Sunday New York Times crossword, graduate early, speak several languages, and know everything that is happening on the globe smart. Did I mention how amazing her style is? She was also going to be a ballerina, so she truly has grace and poise, but the best part is she laughs hard at a joke. She likes people being who they truly are, and the whole family has an incredible sense of humor. Ari and I bonded on our love of hearts. I told him I was making a book about them. He collects old Americana art, and a big part of his collection is all things hearts. He also cares about history and preservation, and wouldn't you know it, he's on the board of a whaling museum, and I had just done a film about whales and had read thousands of pages on them while stuck up in Alaska by myself for months on end, and was so excited to share it with someone. 'Cause not everyone wants to talk about the intricacies of whales. But we did. It was an absolute dream of an evening. And that night, I truly fell in love. Not just with Will, but his parents too. Affectionate, worldly, humorous. They were everything you could dream of. The strong stability and abundant love of their family unit helped utterly clarify what I was feeling inside that felt a little unknown. I was thinking about family as well. I wasn't a girl who fancied a boy. I was asking myself the big question of how will this all function? And a lot of that is the choices you make. The one thing I swore that I would take seriously was a child, serious as a heart attack. It was the one thing I would not screw up. I knew I would not even have children ultimately if there was any doubt. I came from the blueprint of what not to do, and I wouldn't even consider having children until I had the tangible antidote to my experience. After an old-fashioned meeting of the parents, Will and I took off. We traveled the world for a whole year. The old "how will this function?" question is answered very well with travel. Nancy always says love should be like The Amazing Race. She asks, do you want to be the couple that works as a team or the ones who don't function together? It's true. I used to be late to everything and pack last minute and make going to the airport a nail biter, and Will finally said, no more. He told me that it gave him too much anxiety. And so, for the first time, instead of saying my classic, this is who I am, I thought about what that would sound like. No, I like being a mess who gives everyone an ulcer on travel day, only to potentially miss the flight and ruin the trip. Yeah, that wasn't worth fighting for, so I said okay, and started packing the night before. We went everywhere from Austin to Africa. Hawaii was my favorite trip. We rented a house and cooked and hiked. And for the first time in my life, I slept peacefully. We would make trips to New York and hang out with his family. I met Jill, his sister, and her three kids, Sadie, Ivy, and Fletcher. Each kid completely different, but all awesome. They are fearless. And Jill promotes their autonomy like no one else. Jill was like a revelation. When I met her, I couldn't believe my eyes or ears. If Morticia Adams got blended with Oscar Wilde with a dash of Lucille Ball, then that would half describe Jill. She is brassy, bold, and intelligent. She is the woman at the table having everyone wide-eyed but laughing hysterically at the thing she has the nerve to say. And you love it. But she is also incredibly thoughtful, always has her thank you cards in ahead of time, and is the person you want to hang out with at the end of the day. Again, I fell in love. Will and Jill were planning Ari and Coco's 40th anniversary surprise party in Idaho, where the family has gone every Christmas since Ari and Coco met. This was the big one, and on December 26th, the evening took place, and I was just watching in awe. In this intimate room of about 40 people who have all known this family since the beginning, Will and Jill read a poem they wrote for their parents out loud that was the greatest and funniest thing you've ever heard. And in this warm little room with close friends and family, the snow fell outside. And as we drove home, I got a funny feeling. When we were inside, I brought out the candle for the night as I had brought a travel menorah. It was the seventh night of Hanukkah, and to honor Will, who is Jewish, I wanted to provide a way to celebrate his religion. We lit the candle and said thank yous for this incredible night. We were as warm in our hearts as the candle we held, and I felt almost dizzy with the amount of love and goodness I had just witnessed. Will said he would be right back, and I didn't watch what he was doing. I just stared at the burning flames. Just then, I felt a total rush. I turned around as Will was on his knee with a ring box. Oh my God. I have no idea what we both said in that moment, but all I do know is that we had both fought to get here. And although our paths look clearly different, somehow we had found our way to this love. And we knew we wanted to build on that love. And so I said yes, and 3 weeks later, I found out I was pregnant. Of course, we told Ari and Coco first. I was so excited to be having a child in these people's world that I knew I was off to the right start to do everything different. This safe, unbreakable family was getting a new member, and I just felt so lucky. We all decided to have the wedding in June when I would be 6 months pregnant. I loved the idea that our child would be able to attend. And as we were planning the wedding, I called Ari. "Hello, Ari," I said. "Oh, Drew." And he yelled for Coco to get on the line. This is what they always do when one of their kids calls. I pictured Coco picking up the 1980s cordless to join the call. "Hi, guys," I said. "We have been planning along, and I wanted to ask both of you a question." They said, "Of course." "Coco, I was wondering if you wanted to walk down the aisle with Will so that we could all walk together. And Ari, I was wondering if you would give me away." He took a second. "Oh, wow," he said. "Are you sure?" "Of course. There isn't any other way I can picture it." He said yes, and we did. On the day when the four of us were getting ready to walk down the aisle together, I looked around. Sadie, Ivy, and Fletcher were flower girls and boy, and Jill was getting ready to read a passage from The Velveteen Rabbit. And I looked over and saw Coco. I saw that she was truly happy. She was wiping a tear as she was kissing Will, and all I could think was that I have to always make her feel that he is happy too. I love her and respect her to no end. I thought, I hope to be a mother in any way like Coco. She is my idol as a woman. She took Will's arm. We walked down the aisle, and when I reached the chuppah, Ari lifted my veil and kissed my cheek. Little girl fantasy, check. My dream had come true. My husband that night made a great speech, and all the Kobelman's lifelong friends were there, which I felt was important, and all my friends who were my original family were there. Jill made the best speech ever and had everyone howling, of course, and most important, Olive was there. Our daughter, who we hadn't met yet, but who was about to be the apple of her grandparents' eye. When Olive was born, Ari turned to me and said with his classic Ari whole-face smile, "There's nothing overrated about being a grandparent." And he means it. Olive and her cousins have the best grandparents one could ever imagine. He said the same thing when Frankie, our second daughter, was born. They were there for both births and held each girl hours after they were born. And when I would watch them holding their granddaughters, all bundled up, fresh and new after their long journey in my body, I would thank God for Will's parents. I couldn't love them more. And for the first time, I am part of a family. In the lottery of life, I hit the in-law jackpot. The really big one. All ages party. I never know anyone's age. I cannot tell if someone is 30 or 50. I can't tell if you are 23 or 33. And I have no idea with kids. Babies I can now nail because I am a mom who has gone through 3 years of stages, so I can tell in a second how old your little one is to the week. But the reason I don't know age is because one valuable lesson my mother taught me was that age didn't matter. And therefore, I was taught not to pay attention. She would speak emphatically about people being mature or immature, but it never had anything to do with a number. She said that young people might be beyond their years and someone older might be childlike. She never asked anyone his or her age, and she lied about hers. I had to sneak in once when she was showering and go into her purse and pull out her driver's license like a thief and look at the age. Then, when I confronted her, she told me that it wasn't true because they had to make up a birth certificate for her because she was born in a displaced persons camp in Germany and thus she had no real birth certificate. Therefore, the driver's license wasn't accurate. Then I would press her again for her real birth date, and she would just look at me with a sly smile as if I was foiled again and saunter out of the room, leaving me confused and not knowing what to believe. Was she lying? And if so, which part was she lying about? The age? The certificate? I would start to look up German camp years and history, but with no internet and no encyclopedias at my disposal, I would forget by the time I got to school, and my schools were always hippie messes with no real library. I guess I could have asked someone, but a 7-year-old asking about a displaced persons camp seemed odd, and I felt vulnerable asking anyone. Who was she? How old was she? How old was I? I didn't feel 7. I felt older. And she was always hanging out with younger people, so maybe age wasn't what it seemed anyway. Maybe she was right. In fact, all my friends were older because that's where I was in life. When I was a kid, I didn't connect with kids. Now, I love hanging out with kids, and I find them so very fascinating. The things my daughter says to me at 3 are so charming, I can't take it. I would much rather talk to her. And I for sure know people who are wise for their age, and I know adults who are proverbial children and are totally stifled in life. So hell, maybe she's right. Age doesn't matter. I have always celebrated an all-ages party in my work. I want it to be inclusive to all. I have never been concerned with trying to land a certain crowd. I want everyone to feel invited. So come on. Come one, come all. Even if you are 1 or 100, it doesn't matter. In fact, it all begins and ends in diapers, if you're lucky. And for the record, I still don't know my mother's age. I guess it will have to remain a mystery. But age is never my concern. It never will be. It's the person inside the shell that draws me in or doesn't. When all my different employers for all my different endeavors ask me the question, what ages is this for? I always say the same thing. Everyone, hopefully. Because I want an all-ages party. It's so much more fun. This year, at my 40th birthday party, I had a dinner with all my lifelong friends. Some were friends from school, some were mentors, in-laws, and it was a mixed bag of ages for sure, and yet all these people mean so much to me. But one of the most compelling aspects of the night was the fact that for the first time in my life, I finally felt my age. When I was young, I never got to be a kid. Then, when I was in my teens and 20s, I was aggressively trying to recapture my childhood and finally be carefree the way that I thought kids got to be because I never got that chapter. Now, I feel like a woman. A mom. I own a cheese board. The truth is, I still feel like a kid in moments, but I actually feel like I have truly intersected with my number. I am 40. I am really happy. And I am lucky to say that it feels really great. This is Drew Barrymore. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Wildflower. This program was produced and directed by Dan Musselman. Yes. Text copyright 2015 by Drew Barrymore. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.